Session number 15433.
Or Peter McAtee, side four. People saying things to you.
Yeah, they'd say, you know, your behaviour's this and that, you know, you're a disgrace to the regiment. And you know, I used to get hang-ups about it. I mean, you know, for example, one officer told me, guys like you, when the time comes, you're never there. You know, when the shooting starts, well, I'll tell you something. An awful lot of shooting started, and I was always there. Right. And the same officer that said that to me, never actually got yourself into combat.
Did you take this criticism to heart?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Sure.
Because, you know, I prided myself in being a warrior. Yeah. You know, I wasn't in the army to be a nice guy. Mm. I was in the army to close with the enemy and kill him. Mm. And, you know, that was what I wanted to do. Mm. I wanted Britain to have war so as I could be there.
What sort of... and you believe what they said at the time?
Yeah, I did, yeah. And, you know, it actually got to me as well.
Mm. Yeah. What sort of... almost a leading question. What sort of people irritated you? The nature of person irritated you the most?
The snob. The SAS snob was... I used to see chaps there, and he was fighting last night, and the only reason they spoke like that was because they couldn't look after themselves. You know, it's all right seeing this big sort of macho SAS guy, but you know, an awful lot of... You know, SAS soldiers are good on triggers. Can you see that? And 10 men well led are better than 100 without a head. I mean, soldiering isn't about unarmed combat and you know, beating each other to death with clubs. Soldiering is about putting bullets into the enemy. Can you see that? Bringing artillery fire onto him. These guys were good at it. Some of them weren't quite what they should be when it came to sort of looking after themselves physically, but then again, that's not a requirement in modern war. So for me, I actually say that they were wimps or anything like that would be wrong, but it's just, I found they irritated me. Mm. And you know, and the other thing was is I couldn't stand hard cases, although I was one myself. You know, it was interesting, yeah.
Somebody would come in and reckon they were Jack the Lad?
No, you know, for example, I get into one fight, and it was an American. And I allowed myself to be set up. He was a lot older than I was, and he was on about, you know, I'm an Indian and...
A red Indian.
Yeah, a red Indian, and, he was on about knife fighting and all this, and I said, shut up, mate, and like we didn't know anything about being a warrior, so he lights his big cigar and he's sort of blowing smoke in my face, you know, and it's, you know, the eyeball to eyeball thing that, anyway, I finish up sort of beating him, you know, and you know, the fact is...
Right, this is in Fort Bragg.
In Fort Bragg, you know.
In a bar or a mess?
In a military club.
Were you disciplined for that?
Oh, I got sent back to the Paris.
Yeah. Oh.
Aye. See, what happened is, I was in the bar, and I got in a fight with this red Indian, and one of the corporals from the regiment said, I bet you couldn't do that with me. So I done it with him. And I got...
Oh, so you just smacked him, did you?
I just walloped him. And, and you know, in actual fact, he was a good man as well. It's just, we were in an environment where I was drunk. There's drink thrown about. And as it happened, the guy was a jock, and... He liked his alcohol as well, but you know, in the army, you just don't go hitting corporals and getting away with it.
And with these officers or whoever it might be that you didn't hold in high regard,
yeah.
Did you say, you don't know who you're talking about? So
no, I wouldn't, because the officer corps was the officer corps. When I say this, you know, can I try and put this right here? There was some awful good officers in the British Army, good officers. But, you know, there was a lot of them weren't so good either. And, you know, they tended to talk a bit more and mouth a bit more than they were actually entitled to. I never actually told anyone, I just observed it, and that was my observations.
Okay. How long were you in Fort Bragg?
I was there for 4.5 months.
4.5 months. Aye. And what were you doing? You were doing training there?
Yeah.
What sort of...
With 16 troops, we concentrated on parachute training.
Right.
Because we wanted to get our free fall up to standard, because we were the free fall troop.
Right.
So we did an awful lot of parachute training, and we did an awful lot of exercises as well.
Right. Halo, when did that come in?
That came in 62.
Right, so that time. Yeah. Right. When did they... I'm not sure. When did the Americans move away from the A-teams of 10-man A-teams and all that sort of thing? Or I don't even know how that works with them.
No, from what I can believe, I think they've still got that formation yet.
They don't even operate below then?
I think what they did do is, I think at one stage they may have split the team in half in 2 5-man groups. I don't know. But and I just know in Vietnam, for certainly, they operated in the A-team, you know.
But even the Russians work in force.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you whack the corporal.
Yeah.
And you're RTU.
Aye.
Return to unit.
Yes, I go back to Hereford. Mm. And the regiment, you know, although you get this disciplined regiment, you know, they don't want to lose soldiers. I mean, it costs too much money to train them. Anyway, they sent me away in 2 weeks' leave, and to finish the leave and then go back to the parachute regiment. You know, they didn't kick me straight back to the parachute regiment. You're not getting any leave. They said, go and have 2 weeks' leave. Report back to the paras, and all the documentation was done. And I got back to the paras, and it was like I went back to the depot again. Now, by this time, I've turned super cool. You know, I've been with all the old soldiers. I know, I'm gaining a little bit of experience in the soldiery. Although I'm still a young man and a young soldier, but I get back into this insanity of the parachute regiment again. You know, the regimental depot, which is, you know, the machine for turning the man into the para. Can you see that? Mm. And, you know, I already considered myself a para, and I got landed in the depot for a month. Oh, it was unbearable. I mean, I was working in kitchens, cleaning. I was on fatigues for a full month, you know, doing guards. I says, this is terrible.
Mm. And did you, apart from the fatigues, on, were you fine?
No, just that was a punishment, RTU.
Yeah, right, yeah. RTU.
I got back there. And the whole month of December, I was in the depot, and they told me that I was flying out to Bahrain to join one para on the 3rd of December. That was 63. Mm. Yeah.
So you finish your fatigues, and then one para.
I flew out to join one para in Bahrain.
And then, so what happened then? I mean, you.
I got to one.
To ask a silly question, really, you wind up. Yeah.
And I get posted to A Company. I mean, and there was a sergeant major in the A Company at that time called Nobby Arnold. Very, very famous parachute soldier. Extremely awkward and difficult parachute soldier. So I turned up at the office the next morning after arriving in Bahrain, being posted to A Company. And they said, the company early sergeant says, the sergeant major wants to see you at 8 o'clock outside the office. So I went at 8 o'clock. And he came out at 10 o'clock and said, go and have a cup of tea. I came back at 10:30, and I stood there till 12:30.
In Bahrain?
In Bahrain.
What time of year?
This was in January. Oh. Fairly warm, yeah. I mean. He said, go and have your lunch. Come back here at 2 o'clock. Came back at 2 o'clock, stood there till 4:30. He says, go home.
Was that under shade or?
Oh, was it under shade? But you know, it was tin roofs. Yeah. I mean,
it was standing to attention more.
Stand at ease.
At ease.
So that went on for 3 days. And on the third day, he came up to me and says, where's your ID card? You know? And it had to be in the pocket. And the guys have all worn me. And I says, this guy's crazy. You know, so anyway, he takes me in the office and I'm subjected to this lecture about how I'm not good enough to fit into his company. I mean, I got there and I mean, one para at that time, A Company in one para, it made the Foreign Legion look like some joke. I mean, it was the discipline within it was iron. You know, all you did, I mean, you weren't allowed to smile. There was no form of happiness in it. It was, and it was an extremely good company, but you know, if you get smiled, you were suspect. And the other thing about the battalion at that time, if you stepped out of line of the battalion, a company commander would pull a guy in and say, if you don't pull your socks up, you're going to finish up in A Company. It was, you know, I mean, a company commander called Jack Thorpe, I mean, his heart was in the right place. I mean, he wanted men of iron. I know that was his name was Iron Jack. But he had this sergeant major who tended to do it his way. And he all got an awful lot of time for Nobby, you know, and I understand his methods since. But it still was insanity. Can you see that? And everything was always done with pain and, you know, 60, you know, all your webbing was all covered in, your webbing was full of sand. And, you know, and the standard of training within that company was fairly high. In that, I mean, I've seen a full company jumping up and down with a kit on, and you can't hear it rattling. You heard it creaking, but you never heard it rattling. You know, and I mean this. I mean, we lived in terror there. I joined them in January, and we stayed there till the end of May. And this man, like, I'd be company early sergeant.
Yeah.
Right, I'd walk down the lines, and you get a broom handle. If you wanted to get everybody out of bed in the morning, and you just go like with the broom handle, dick, 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 down the lines. By the time you got to the bottom of the lines, everybody was out of bed because they thought it was Nobby with his pay stick. You know? And I get sent on an NCO's carner, it was interesting. And Jack Thorpe ran the carner.
Right. And you were... There were based there in Bahrain.
Aye.
And that was what? That was on an operational posting or training? Or?
No, we were on standby to go to Kuwait. You know, because the guy before Hussein was called Saddam, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was threatening to take Kuwait as well.
All right.
So two para had been out there. And one para had been out to relieve them.
Mm.
And...
And how long were they actually there from beginning to
end? We did a 9-month tour there.
All right.
One part of the year there.
And what, I mean, at that time, I mean, there was a social life. I mean, you got a naffy or
there was
drink?
There was a naffy and it was heavy, heavy drinking.
Yeah.
You know, and...
were they allowed spirits at that time?
Oh,
the naffy? Yeah.
Yeah. The thing about that battalion is, there wasn't a fat man in that battalion.
No.
I mean, they were like jockey's whips. I mean, they were fit.
Yeah.
And, you know, deeply tanned. And, you know, and you sort of did 6 weeks working in the camp.
Mm.
This was the routine. Then you do 6 weeks at the airfield at Maharak training.
Mm.
Then at the culmination of your training, you packed your container and you jumped into... The training also included you being in standby to go to Kuwait as the standby company.
Right.
Then when you finished the standby company, you packed your kit was all packed, and you actually jumped into Sharjah and simulated what you'd be doing in Kuwait.
Right.
So you had a training...
An exercise Sharjah.
Yeah.
What aircraft were they using?
They're using Beverleys.
Beverleys.
Yeah. Old aircraft.
Yeah.
And the other thing I noticed it came to mind there was... You know, you get an aircraft here.
That's a flying box car.
Yeah, flying box car is the C-119. It's the American aircraft. Just a big elephant, massive. Right. And you could actually jump out the tail of it as well.
Okay.
What I remember about Bahrain was we're flying from Maharak to across to Sharjah to jump. And the heat in the aircraft, I mean, it was just... And we were actually soaking. Our boots, you know, the sweat running down our body... down onto your socks and their boots. Our boots were actually slopping with the heat.
Yeah.
And you know, all you had on, you wore a pair of KD trousers, a parachute smock with nothing under it. Can you see that? And maybe just a vest.
Mm.
And you know, your parachute and all your kit on top of it.
Mm.
I mean, by the time you got on the ground there, I mean, you were totally dehydrated.
Yeah.
And you did this, we had this obsession at the time for, you know, not drinking water. You know, you had two bottles and you know, you were wetting your lips and it was, you know, it was like something that will jest.
Yeah. Whereas now, it's the reverse. Aye. You must have 8 pints of water a day.
What I used to do later on in my life, if I knew my soldiers were going to have a long march, I'd make them jump in with a load of water. Can you see it? And we'd drink the water the minute we hit the ground.
Right.
So as you know, everything that the body fluid they'd lost flying.
Right.
I mean, this is in Africa.
Yes.
It was all replaced.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, nobody ever thought about things like that then, you know.
No. Okay. You went back on this NCO carder.
Yeah.
Where did you do that?
I did it in Bahrain. It was at Maharak Airfield.
All right.
You know, and we did it there. And that is when... I'd learned an awful lot about skill in the SAS. But at that time, the SAS was very prone to giving cigarette pack orders, you know. You know, the orders on the back of a little piece of paper and just rattle off. Whereas the thing about the parachute regiment was the basics. They were very, very thorough. For example, gun firing all right, gun stops, cock gun, mag off, fresh mag on, carry on firing, gun stops one or two, he fires one or two more and stops again, cock gun, apply the safety catch, move up the side of the gun, move the take out your barrel, put it to a different gas set and pull it back down, close it, carry on, safety catch off, carry on firing. That is how it was in the parachute regiment.
Right.
You never forget it.
Right.
And it's drilled into you. So I then went back and, you know, I learned about the issue and the extraction of orders, which I never really understood before, and it was it was a marvellous, that NCO's card was a marvellous learning process for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd learned an awful lot about skill and personal soldiering and, you know, personal movement in the SAS, but when it came to actually learning to become an NCO, and I think the parachute regiment, and the other thing was, although this company was insanity, you know, I learned they were a
good, you realised you were there,
a good infantry company. Can you see that? Yeah. I mean, A company, I'd have, we were proud of being A company. Can you see that? Although we had Nobby, who we needed Nobby, we needed somebody to hate, and Nobby supplied that, you know.
Yeah. But it was also because of the environment, perhaps. What was the accommodation like there?
The accommodation was tin huts.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a fan in the hut. All the fan did was circulate the hot air, you know.
But there's no air conditioning?
No.
All right, and the food was...
The food was parachute regiment food. It was garbage, you know. Yeah. And if there's one
thing... Hot garbage and hot...
And then we used to get these rubber eggs, you know. I think they were injected or something, but they'd put them on these trays and fry them. And, you know, you got them and, you know, you'd sort of hit it with your knife and your knife would sort of spring back, you know. And the other thing there was water. Drinking water was actually as expensive as petrol at that time. You know, and so the in the kitchen there wasn't an abundance of that. They had these sort of machines and they had this lemonade powder, you know, you put it in and make a drink out of it, you know, and 3/4 of the time it didn't dissolve, you know, it was stuff that was left over from World War II, you know.
Uh-huh. It was probably quite tacky water, was it?
Desalinated. Yeah. And you couldn't enjoy a glass of water there. Guys tended to drink a lot of pop. You know, we'd go to the movies at night time and there'd be pop bottles lying all over the place after the movie, you know.
Yes, yes. The NCO carder.
Aye. Right, I went there and I felt lucky that and that the chief instructor there was a chap called Reg Melody. And he was one of the new breed of parachute soldiers. Mm-hmm. He was 28 years old, a sergeant major. Can you see that?
Right.
And, you know, when you looked at Reg... He was everything he wanted to become, mm-hmm. you know, and he was a good man with it as well. And he was moving into a new era. This, you know, don't do as I do as I say, it was starting to go out then. Mm-hmm. And I saw nothing but example from him. And the other thing that came across was the thoroughness and the attention to detail, you know, that we were made pay to it. And, you know, you'd have a notebook and pencil and Jack Thorpe would come along and say, show me your notes. And if they hadn't been, you were allowed to take fast notes, but if those notes hadn't been transferred into another book the next day, and they say, where's your notes for so-and-so? I mean, Jack was on your back. Mm-hmm. And you know something? It was a better way of learning as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get all this carrying, I'll put it on the computer, I can recall it. But when you're writing something out constantly, mm-hmm. you tend to remember it more.
Yeah. What happened after you finished your NCO carder?
Right, I went to A Company, and I went to... one platoon as a section commander. I was promoted.
This is still in Bahrain.
Still in Bahrain.
Right. And so that went on for a bit.
It went on and then we came back from... It was terribly uneventful.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is what actually came out at the end of Bahrain was my navigation had actually come together.
Okay.
We did this parachute exercise. We parachuted into Sharjah and we did an exercise called Nimble. Mm. Exercise Nimble. And by this time I'd learned to trust compasses and I just battered across the desert and, you know, I was the first guy in, you know, with my section.
And, so what happened after you finished in Bahrain?
We came back to England, we got a month's leave and we came back from the month's leave and then we just started doing exercise upon exercise, you know, Germany, France.
Where did you go in France?
Po, you know,
Po Parachute Centre, yeah.
And it was just constant exercises.
Yeah. Anywhere else?
We went to Northern Ireland, the next size there. We done a few in Scotland. You know, it was mainly UK-based exercises with a big join and the big annual NATO exercise.
Right.
And that went on for a year.
Yeah.
And we came back from Bahrain. No, wrong. Came back from Bahrain in 63. It went on for 6 months. And we went home for Christmas leave. And we were called off Christmas leave.
Off Christmas leave?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To go to Cyprus with the United Nations.
All right. Okay. Yeah. You went this month's leave, when was that?
The month's leave was, we got back in May, and that took us through to June. And then we started training.
What did you do in your month's leave after all this?
I came home, and as I say, I was still writing to this lassie, Margaret Bradley.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, we went out, and it was, you know, it was a normal carry on. You put on a load of weight as well, you know.
Yeah.
And I came back off that, and it was, you know, when you see my mates and.
Yeah. What did they make of you in the parachute regiment?
The funny thing was, the actual policeman in the district who had been booting my arse, say, 2 years beforehand, they were actually chuffed for me.
Oh, really?
Oh, they come up and say, right, you've done the right thing, young fella. That's it, now keep it up. I don't want to see you back on the streets here again. You know? Because we used to hate them, you know? It was a sort of ongoing feud between us and them. And they were actually happy for me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. But they probably got medals up themselves, had they?
I saw some of them were ex army guys herself, and you know, they were pretty prone to battering, you know. We used to have a joke, that well known Glasgow disease, you know, hitting the head with a policeman's baton.
Okay. Did they bother you? I mean, did people, I mean, you said you got to the top of the class as far as the self defence stakes. For people to stop bothering you at that stage, or?
No, I'll tell you what happened is.
You're in uniform, I was going to say.
Yeah.
At that time, did you always wear uniform?
No, you come home, you maybe wore it home. You try to impress people and whatnot, the normal young soldier. But I never really get bothered because you weren't home long enough to get into a rut. Can you see that again?
So you're going to say that, I'll tell you what happened. So that's what happened. You're treated with more respect still?
Oh, from the police and then...
From your mates?
Oh, yeah. And they were always happy. And the other thing was, they were broke all the time. So when I came home, you always get your ration allowance to come home with, and I always had a few bob more than they had. So, you know, we all tended to get together and, and you know, have a good time, go to the dancing and whatnot.
What jobs were they doing then now? I mean, was there unemployment?
There was terrible unemployment. Yeah. See, everyone was in dead-end jobs, like... My mate Sam, he got a job, and when you were 21, you were entitled to a man's wages, so they paid you off. So he was, you know. And, of course, by that time he's married, he's got a kid on the way. His wife can't work because she's expecting a kid, and then the game's on. The syndrome begins, you know, you're in the slums, you're not working. And it's just the circle that carries on and on, you know. And he hasn't really broken out of it yet. You know, I seen him last year.
So he's not working, or?
No.
No. Right. So, you came back off leave, and then you went out to Cyprus with the United Nations.
Yeah.
How did you find that?
Let me tell you.
That was
the first United Nations tour to Cyprus.
Right.
In actual fact, what happened was, I was lying in my bed, and we'd all been out having a drink. It was New Year's Eve. I was lying in my bed, and you know you're lying, and you're sort of coming to, and my dad went, "There's a telegram for you, son." I says, "Was it?" Boxer, that was the code word for return. I says, "Aye," and I went on to the central station, and we got on the and all the jocks were all still drunk, you know. And I'm like, "What's going on here?" You know, and they sort of ties around the side of the neck. So we all boarded the train to Aldershot, and they says, "Right," and it was the ruthlessness of the whole thing, though. You know, we got in there and they went, "You're only allowed a parcel." You know, and I'd started collecting things like badges and militaria. So you're allowed one parcel for your clothes. I says, "Right, that's all you can have. We're sorry, it's not our responsibility." So I finished up giving all my military away to people. And you parceled your civvies up, and they sent them home for you. So we arrived out in Cyprus, you know, quick move, called back off leave, on aircraft the next day. We go out to Cyprus and sit for 3 weeks in a camp. And so we finally start getting deployed around Cyprus and UN tours. And, you know, we're starting to see the normal thing that happens when these sort of civil-type wars start, you know. Civil war type situations, and you know, dead bodies lying all over the place, massacres here, and got fired on a couple of times, you know, and then we were starting to, you know, get used to, you know, fire coming over our head and whatnot. It was a fairly uneventful tour. Did that for 5 months. Now, this is the parachute regiment again. towards the end of the tour, we were broken into company groups and we were behaving terribly, terribly naughty, you know. You know, guys were going to need fights, and it was the battalion in general. So, and I've spoken about this, and the parachute regiment, it gets easy going at times, and it's almost as casual as the SAS. And every so often you have these purges. And then, anyway, we come back, and the CO speaks to us before we leave Cyprus. He says, "Right, chaps, on the way back from Cyprus, on a return from leave, what are we going to do is some serious retraining, you know." So we go, "Great, we're going to do exercises here, you know, Germany, NATO and all that." So our imagination is running riot. We go on the battalion square on the day after leave. So unbeknown to us, the sergeant majors were called back after 2 weeks. They were gripped by the sergeant major. The sergeants were called back after 3 weeks. They were gripped by the sergeants. So we're all, the whole battalion's on the square there. And everybody's sort of, the odd guy with the hair curling up at the back and whatnot. And you can smell a rat. You know, all there is couples on the square that says, "What's going on here?" And the sergeant's mess from a place called Gilliamont Barracks. And the sergeant's mess was right at the top of the square. And the doors of the mess burst open. And these maniacs come marching out with pea sticks. And everybody sort of broke off and went towards their companies, you know. And the next thing is shouting and bawling, "Take his name, got him, sir." You know, and guys getting marched off to Nick, you know. This was the serious...
For being improperly dressed.
Ah, you know, like it was a... You know, like in the parachute regiment, it's sort of, you know, a guy would have dirt in his rigging lines, you know. And by the time everybody had added a bit onto the charge, it was, you know, dirty cap badge. You know, by the time we got to the end of the line, "Cap badge rendered unserviceable," you know. Guy getting marched off the neck. And I had a mate called John Buchanan. And John just said, "I came back to the billet," and John was packing his kit, you know. I says, "Where are you going?" He says, "Peter, if I'm going to go in, Nick, I'll go for something." He just packed his bags and left. He says, "I'll come back when this is over." You know, it was honestly, it was insanity, and it went on rifting drill parade. You know, and it's a paras because every so often they've got to grip them and bring them back into the fold. Mm. And as I say, John Buchanan came back.
He deserted, effectively.
He came back just prior to desertion. Can you see that?
I see. Right.
He came back and the CEO said, "Yes, we can." He says, "Well, sir, I saw some form of insanity starting to prevail in the battalion. And you know, to be quite frank, sir, is, you know, I'd have finished off in Nick anyway, and I thought I may as well get it for something." And the CEO said, "Went, yeah, okay, 28 days, Nick." Can you see that? they knew what it was all about as well. Mm. And then things would start normalizing again, you know. And you go back on, once you were back on the even keel and they thought they had a pound of flesh, you were back onto it again.
Right.
Yeah.
But that was because everybody got too lax, they felt in Cyprus.
We were working in company groups and we were doing our own thing, you know.
Yeah.
Guys were stealing meat out of a big meat factory and, you know, we were on, there was a big coal store in the middle of Nicosia. A couple of the guys get in there and looted it, you know.
Or the truck.
You know, they're just big stakes and that, you know. Ah. So I was over at Kyrenian's.
Yeah.
You know, some of the guys turned up with chickens and they'd raided this chicken factory during the night, you know. Then it started that there was an ongoing thing that A company was swapping D company for chickens for meat, you know. And it was picked up and, you know, heads had to roll, you know.
But you were talking about, what did you make about all these massacres and so forth and bodies and... beach side.
I looked at it and I couldn't understand something. And the thing that actually came across to me, you know, as a very junior soldier, was the lack of discipline by the people involved in this.
Right.
You know, there was, you know, you'd get guys run about and they looked like, it was the first time I'd seen sort of semi-dressed soldiers. You know, they'd have a piece of American kit, you know, with a piece of Greek kit.
Yeah.
You know, and they were sort of surly looking characters, you know. And probably because I didn't understand what the situation was about. I mean, I was only out there to do as I was told. They weren't too hot in giving you political briefings at that time, you know. Mm. You know, putting the picture about what's going on. We were just told, this is, get on with it and stop this. And we done fairly well, you know.
When you came under fire and so forth, were you able to return fire? Or
no, we weren't. We were blessed by a good old company commander at the time called Wallace King, ex-Coldstream Guards. And Wallace's big pose was he'd just walk down the street and they'd be firing at him all over the place and he wouldn't lose his pose. Can you see that? And we're going, okay, champion, wheel, you know. They used to try and unsettle him, and they couldn't do it with Wallace. But one of the younger officers tried to come this pose, you know, and his bottle couldn't take it. You know?
What happened then?
Oh, he sort of walking down the road, and a couple of shots went, and he says, "This is not for me," right into a doorway, whereas Wallace would just plod on, you know.
And this actually happened, he just walked down the
street. Aye, oh, yeah.
With bullets winging.
Aye, they go wing, you know, and they were trying to unsettle him, and this young officer, you know, tried to pose. And there was another time in Cyprus, we had this guy called the Right Honourable Lord Wrottesley, who was part of the battalion. And he...
Solid.